The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
So we escaped New Orleans. Originally, we got to New Orleans 6 a.m. on Monday. I was going to leave 11 a.m. noon on Tuesday. Didn't end up leaving until about 10 a.m. on Thursday. By my estimations, it took us 5 hours to drive what should have been a two-hour drive. Most of I-10 was shut down for, I'm assuming, snow removal. Trying to get out of the city was, by even after 2 days after the snow had finished falling, was incredibly difficult. I won't say a nightmare, but it was difficult. There was issues. There was a problem. A lot of the roads and bridges were still closed off. Like I said, I-10 was closed off. And so I had to take smaller two-lane highways that are like 45 miles an hour maximum speed limit. And of course, there was other people on the road, so a little bit of traffic. It wasn't so much traffic. It was just driving slower on smaller highways. By my estimation, I think a 150 to 200 mile stretch of I-10 was closed, which is even weirder because the farther you got away from New Orleans, the less snow there was. I mean, as soon as you got out of the city limits, there was pretty much no snow. Maybe the remnants of 1 or 2 inches of snow. But we made it out. We made it as far as Houston. I found a punk rock bar, like metal bar called The Secret Group that does like karaoke and they have bands and obviously comedy and the guys that run a comedy show. And I mean guys specifically because they are just that. More going back to playing about guys. The comedy show, they had a comedy show and then an open mic afterwards. I messaged them ahead of time. I was like, hey, is it cool to still get a spot on the open mic? Because it was kind of vague, the info on their website or in the Facebook events about sign up. Of course, I don't get a reply, but I get there, I finally talk to somebody, they're like, yeah, no problem. And I watched the show beforehand, and it's just a string of just unfunny dudes. I literally had to walk out of the room because I get tired after the fifth comedian in a row just talking about eating ass. It's like, this is what you guys want to do with your comedy? Is this is what you want to talk about? How fake scenarios of your girlfriend beating you up and how you're a pedophile? Not one woman on the show. There's not one woman who does comedy in all of Houston that you could book. Diabetes and not type 2, but clearly I'm type 2 material. Like the only thing I'm going to be first out of my group of friends is beating them to the grave. All right, fuck you guys. Don't back up on me now. This is an open mic, which means the back of this room is all full of comedians, which means each one of them knows exactly how much weight their ceiling fans can support. Hey, sound guy, can you bring up the lights? I think I made it too dark. And of course, it goes back to what the thing I complained about. Every joke premise is a question for the audience. Like, why are you going out there just asking the audience questions? And there's also nobody there. So you're asking questions to nobody. It's not like you're doing crowd work. You're just trying to set up your joke, asking a question. It gets so grueling asking these rhetorical questions over and over, but still expecting some kind of response. I drove west as fast as I could down Route 190 for that. Of course, by the time the open mic starts, the room actually filled up, and there was a few comedians that were kind of funny a little bit. Like, the room kind of became responsive. There was probably about 20 or so people in there, but of course, as soon as they start the open mic, a slew of more unfunny guys come along and just walk the entire room. Half the audience had left by the time I went up, and I was only comedian number 6, number 7. My set went all right, given the scenario. But it's hard to try and get a beat on these jokes if what's working when the room keeps getting walked out and killed by a group of, I'm going to talk about how I'm single and how my ex-girlfriend likes to eat ass. And you know what? Watch out for me. I'm going to fuck your kids. Out of context, that's a very disturbing sentence. Even in context, actually, it's a disturbing sentence. But sister's getting better with the drive. She actually is napping a little bit. It takes a few hours of driving for it to actually lay out and stop panting and relaxed. I mean, this morning after we left Houston, I'm on our way to El Paso. Hopefully we can find a spot to do something tonight. And then by my estimations, I'm a day behind because I wanted to spend 2 or 3 days in Texas, you know, Dallas, Austin, maybe Houston, and then move on to Tucson today on Friday, which that's not going to happen. I could probably make it to Tucson tomorrow. I can make it to Tucson tomorrow. But if I try to make it to LA on Sunday, that's a long 8 to 9 hour drive from Tucson to LA. So one of the other things that is, every person's credit basically on this show that was as seen on Kill Tony, which is, now that's a credit, I guess. Kill Tony, if you don't know what it is, it's a podcast of an open mic. Tony Hinchcliffe, who's a comedian, racist comments about Puerto Rico aside, comedian, who's in the sphere of the Joe Rogan crowd of people, hosts basically an open mic, and then they podcast it. Here's the problem with the show. And people I've been talking to people about this because it's incredibly popular now. People love it. They're like, hey, would you ever do Kill Tony? And here's the thing, no. Because it's become such a circus. It's become so outlandish and over the top that you can't get any real jokes done. First off, the entire thing has been populated since day one without real comedians. It's been populated by people who are insane and deranged, people who don't do comedy, but they're comedy fans. They're like, oh, well, I want to be on the podcast, so I'm going to go sign up for it. And basically, it's, what, 1 minute, 2 minutes of material. And the bar has been set so high on being offensive and outlandish and crazy that you can't tell normal jokes. And there's a panel of, you know, Tony Hinchcliffe and other comedians there that kind of judge your material, and it kind of becomes a roast. Sometimes people are complimentary on it. And there's a band there, and it's a spectacle. And I'm, you know, happy for the guy that he built it from that. He built it on the back of insane people. A couple of my friends have done it, and they've done well. But, you know, like, you have to, like, the quality of joke is second to having to be so insanely over the top that it's not worth it. I don't do offensive comedy, I don't think. I don't want to do offensive comedy. I don't want to say something so crazy and outlandish that it gets a reaction. I just want to go out there, tell my stories and my jokes, and make people laugh. You can't really do that on that show anymore. It's such a cavalcade of mentally ill wannabe comedians. You know, they do it in Austin, and he has traveled it around. I mean, they did Madison Square Garden, so it is quite popular, but it's not for me. But anyone could get on it. You just put your name in a bucket, and if you're the lucky one drawn, boom. You have a popular credit of Kill Tony. I'm sure some people have, you know, some people have gone on to doing actual real comedy, like, you know, headlining clubs and getting tours because of how well they do on Kill Tony. But a lot of those people were doing comedy about their disability or how they're disabled. Or, like, there was one woman, Tina Frimmel, I think her name is. Her entire set is about how she has an incurable disease. She's going to die. And so everyone's like, it's the darkest of dark jokes about it. And it's great for her that she's writing comedy about it. But how is that going to compare to anybody else's normal set of just jokes? You know, when you have a cavalcade of dudes who want to hear some woman talk about how she's going to die because apparently they hate all women anyway. I don't. All right. Maybe I'm going a little too far. I've been in a car too long. I've been in a car too much. I've been alone with my thoughts for too long. So let's just look at Texas for a little bit. And also on a positive note, God, do I really like Buc-ee's. If you have not been to a Buc-ee's, it's like a truck stop had a child with a doomsday prepper. It is a huge gas station. with everything you could possibly want on it. The prices are so cheap and reasonable, and the product quality is pretty good. I got a whole big bag of chocolate covered raisins, which I probably shouldn't be eating, but they're very delicious. I got gas, the cheapest gas I've gotten so far, which was $1.51 a gallon. Now, in fairness, it was a dollar off per gallon, up to 15 gallons, because they buy a car wash, and of course I actually wanted to get my car washed. So $16 car wash saved me about $12 or so in gasoline. And the reason I needed to get the car washed, I was wanted to hold off to LA to get the car cleaned and detailed and everything, clear sister's car, dog hairs out of it, and get everything washed and done. But it was so caked in mud and water, snow from the melted snow, everything. No salt. Again, New Orleans has no salt. They didn't put salt on any of the roads. So my car wasn't covered in salt water like it normally is in New England. When it snows, you know, you get the melting snow and the salt. So it was just caked and melted snow mud. So at least I got some cheap gas too. There's the bright side. So I was supposed to hopefully have a show in Tucson, Arizona that I end up having to pass on or miss because of being stuck in New Orleans for those days. And I was just driving from Houston through and I was just not going to make it to Arizona in time. So I missed an opportunity for a show, but I stopped off in El Paso and I decided I was going to sleep in El Paso and then move on, that night. And, it turns out El Paso is very close to the Texas-Mexico border. I didn't know that because I wasn't looking at it where it was on the map. And I accidentally booked a hotel room while I was driving around getting gas and getting myself situated in El Paso. And accidentally booked a hotel in Juarez, Mexico. And now, of course, I did not have my passport with me. I also didn't want to go to Mexico. I accidentally, the directions, it wasn't until I put the directions in my GPS and it put me in line for the Mexico-US-Texas border that I realized, oh, this hotel is in Mexico. No wonder it was so cheap. So lucky I was able to get out of that line before having to get stuck by customs. And I was able to also thank you, Marriott, for refunding my prepaid purchase for that hotel room that I accidentally booked in a country where I don't speak the language and no one at the hotel spoke English. I know I tried calling and they refused to admit that they understood English, but unfortunately, there was also no comedy to do in El Paso. I think there was one club and I reached out to them about a guest spot and heard nothing back, which, yeah, it's the day of. It was the afternoon of. It's not that surprising that they're like, no. So I just had a night off to relax in El Paso. Sister and I sat in the hotel room. We ate a pizza and we just watched some TV, did some podcast work and just enjoyed the night. And then we moved on into New Mexico, which also El Paso is right on the New Mexico border. It's real quick and easy to get into New Mexico. And there's not much to tell about New Mexico because I just drove straight through New Mexico. And that's one of the things about this tour is thinking about the states and cities that you visit and the state. What qualifies as visiting a state? What qualifies as the state that you have been to? Some people say is if you spend a night in that state, you've visited it. I don't know if I agree with that. I definitely don't agree with if you just drive through it, you visited it. That's definitely not the way it is. But I've also been to New Mexico before. When I was younger, in my teenage years, when I was a Boy Scout, we went to this very famous Boy Scout camp there in New Mexico called Philmont Scout Ranch. It's a world famous Scout Ranch. It's in Cimarron, New Mexico. It's just outside of the city of Cimarron, New Mexico, which literally is a one streetlight town. It's in North New Mexico. And it does still, even to this day, hold a special place in my heart. Like it's this very famous Boy Scout camp. The way it works out is, at least when I was a child in the 90s, at least in Maryland, if your scout troop wanted to go to Philmont, there was a lottery because they couldn't accept everybody because it was so popular. So, and I'm pretty sure the lottery meant if you didn't get in the lottery this year, you're automatically guaranteed a spot the year after. And then whatever remaining spots were lottered.
lottoed out. And my troop, my years in my troop, we went twice. I went once. And then when I was much younger, they went a couple years before it. And when I went, I was the youngest in my group to go. I think I was either freshman going to sophomore year or sophomore year going into junior year. And I mean, it's a trek. It's a lot of, it's 7 days on the trail through the desert of New Mexico with, you know, 60 pound pack of your food and your supplies and equipment and everything you're going to need. And it's a very expensive trip. I think back when I was a kid, I want to say it was like $800-$900 to go, which may not seem like a lot of money today, but in the '90s, that was a lot of money. And especially when you're talking about a working class family, like my parents really had difficulty affording that. And then you got the equipment too. It's not just the cost to go, cause it's 2 weeks. It's your airfare, your flight to and from New Mexico. It's your, you know, the way it works is you fly out to New Mexico and half the groups in Maryland, the Boy Scouts of America of Maryland, half the troop has a layover on the way to New Mexico or to Denver, and you get a direct flight on the way home, or vice versa. You get a direct flight to Denver and a layover in Chicago on the way back home. We had the layover in Chicago to it. And I point that up because I've been to O'Hare, never been to Chicago up until last year when I visited Chicago earlier. Yeah. But I mean, somebody would ask me about visiting Chicago. I was like, I've been to O'Hare. That's it. I think we can all agree that does not qualify as visiting a city if you're just a layover at the airport. So you land in Denver, you get on, they put you all on a coach bus, and the coach bus drives 2 days down to Cimarron. You spend one night over sleeping in the gymnasium of this college that has a connection to a native dance group, and they do a whole dance performance for you and educational stuff. And it meant a lot to me as someone who's native and someone who grew up as a, you know, ceremonial performer and native dancer. Yeah. There's a thing you never thought you were going to hear, but yeah, that was a very close to my heart there at the time. And then you did another day of a bus travel to the base camp. And like, it is an intense hike. You're walking, you know, 10 to 20 miles a day with 60 pound pack, everything on your back, out in the middle of Nowheresville, in the middle of the desert, and the valleys and the mountains and the hills. And it's very intense. I remember my friend Bernie, who was in our troop. He was a year or two older than me. Overweight. Right. And they take safety very serious out there because they have to. If you're out in the middle, I mean, you're on the trail for 7 full days. You're at that camp for 10 days. You're in the base camp for 2 days. You're on the trail for 7. You come back to the base camp for another day. You get back on the 2-day coach bus ride back to Denver Airport, and you fly back, in my case, to Baltimore. But I think the week or two before we had arrived, an adult scoutmaster had a heart attack on the trail and died. So not only did they take safety very serious, they took it extra serious when we were there, because our friend Bernie, who's like, he's like 16, 17 years old. Yeah, he's overweight, but they're like, your blood pressure's too high. You're too overweight. We don't think medically that you will be safe on the trip. So you have to stay here at the base camp. Yeah, they could have sent him home. Like, if you think about that, like the money that his family spent so he could take this trip, and he ended up sitting for 7 days by himself. All the rest of us went on the trail, and he was alone, a 16, 17 year old kid, alone in a base camp at a scout ranch where there were very few people around because everybody else was on the trail. I mean, people were constantly coming in and going and going, and man, you got to think about how lonely and how sad, how depressing that is, that you're excited to do this once in a lifetime, potentially a once in a lifetime trek, and then be told that you're too overweight to do it. You know, he had a physical. His doctor let him do it. You also have to get physicals. You have to turn in a doctor's physical before you do this trip to Philmont. I remember feeling so bad for him. Think about how much fun he missed out on. But he is a very outgoing guy. I'm sure he made a lot of friends, especially with the staffer at the base camp. And I'm sure, you know, he enjoyed, like, my troop, we were super intense. Like, you think the kids who are in Boy Scouts are nerds. We were not the nerds. Like, we were nerds, but we were also, like, military nerds. Like, we were intense nerds. We did some, yeah, we took trekking very seriously. We took scout leadership very seriously, my troop. And so it's like, yeah, we were the tech theater. Like, a lot of the kids in my troop, we all went to the same high school together, you know, or one of two high schools together. And yeah, we were, a lot of us were tech theater nerds, but that was because we were a theater intensive high school. So like, we were the cool kids doing tech theater because we knew tech, not because we were nerds. Like, it was, we did some serious, like, we had a rule, no candy while on the trail. You know, you go to do these things and every kid's going to the outpost at the end of the night and they're getting ice cream and candy and snacks and chocolates and all this stuff. And we're like, nope, no sugar on the trail. No sugar on the trail. So, I mean, maybe he enjoyed having, not having to walk 20 miles a day and carry his pack around. And he actually got to sit every night and eat ice cream and candy and whatever he wanted to, where we were pretty intense. There was a couple of adults that gave up coffee while on the trail because, you know, that's their treat. That's their stimulant. That's their sugar. So, you know, we took it pretty serious. Even when we're not at that camp, like when we did our other summer treks, you know, we took some pretty extreme trips. But that's my experience with New Mexico. So I didn't really feel bad about just driving straight through New Mexico. I did stop off. All right. So I think what constituted as visiting a state or visiting a city, I don't think you have to spend the night there. I don't think that's true. I don't believe that. I think if you go there with an intent and a purpose to visit something significant. Like, if I'm here, you know, back home in Boston, if I drive to Providence to try a new restaurant, that's visiting Providence. You know, that's visiting Rhode Island. I went to this thing, even though I didn't spend the night, maybe only been a couple hours, turn around, go back. Stopping off for gas, not significant. Not significant enough. So I did not visit. I did stop in New Mexico at this, you know, rest stop tourist attraction. And I had to. I just had to. They had billboards leading up to it. It's like, the big robot. Come see the big New Mexico robot. And, you know, aliens and I was like, oh, I got to see what this roadside attraction is. And it was pretty cool. It was totally schlocky. It was complete waste of time, but I enjoyed it. Like, you know, they it's New Mexico. So they play into the Area 51 and the aliens and stuff like that. They had this just for no reason. This robot, you know, looked like a Transformer Bumblebee robot display that you just, hey, come see it and take a picture of it. Why? Because we want your business. And of course they have all kinds of t-shirts for sale. It's, you know, they had this really fun little painted exterior that looked like Old West saloons and Old West homes and stuff like that. They're all full of puns and it was adorable. It was cute. We stopped, sister and I stopped in there. I just had to. We didn't get gas, but we stopped and we walked around. We looked at stuff. I found a buck knife that had my name on it. Now, growing up with the name Dennis, you think it's a very common name. It's not common. I grew up a lot of times, you know, you have the license plates or the name tags or so many things you grew up, so many tourist tchotchkes and souvenir stuff have names on them. And growing up as Dennis, very rarely did I ever see Dennis. So the fact that I saw something with my name on it and it's a pocket knife, I'm like, well, I'm going to buy that, you know, and I had a chocolate chip cookie because they smelled so delicious and I'm sure they are prepackaged. You just heat them up. You know, it was not fresh made on premise. Chocolate chip cookies, but even though I had enough, as if I didn't have enough chocolate chip cookies at Flapper's Comedy Club while I was in LA, this was on my way to LA, so I knew there was a lot of chocolate chips in my future, because there's been a lot of chocolate chips in my past. But it was cute. I would never recommend anybody to stop at it other than the whimsiness of it, but it was fine. I enjoyed it. And then we moved on through New Mexico, got back in the car and just went, and it's flat and it's long and it is driving and we drove all the way to Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix, Arizona! Didn't really stop over the night. I mean, I made plans. You know, I tried texting some friends about Phoenix. And I end up just going to a comedy club in Phoenix. It's a big comedy club. It's a chain of them, and I'm forgetting the name of it. But Adam Ray was there performing as his Dr. Phil character. And I was like, oh, most comedy clubs, the way it is with comedy, most comedy clubs, they will let you in, if you're a comedian, just let you into the show for free. And I think if it was a regular night, they would have. But this, the whole place is sold out, packed, you know, multiple shows. They're like, no, we're not. We don't have the room. You can't stand in the back. And it was disappointing because my friend Jeff Wiles, who was a comedian in Boston and then moved to Brooklyn, he was out there and he was doing a set on the show. I didn't know that. Like, I'm literally just walking up the stairs to the comedy club, which is in like a big, huge, like, nightclub brokerage area where you have all the shops and all the bars and everything, you know, like a power plant type area. And that's where the comedy club was located. And I see Jeff and we just kind of did a double take. It's like, what are you doing here? Wait, huh? And so it was nice to hang out with him and see somebody and just chill. And I, you know, we had a couple drinks and we just hung out and got back in the car and just drove overnight. And, you know, it would have been nice to see Adam Ray. I feel regretful that I had opportunities to interview him for news articles and possibly the podcast years in the past. And I feel regretful that I never took the advantage of that because I didn't care about him. I didn't care about his co-host. It was for his podcast about last night. That's what they went. They were coming to Boston. And they wanted me to interview him to help promote the thing. And I just turned it down. I wasn't interested in it. And I regret it. I do regret it. I don't hate his comedy in any way, shape or form, but it would have been nice. I should have taken the opportunity. That's what I'm saying. And apparently Adam's a really nice guy. Jeff opened for him back here in Boston a bunch of years back and remembered him and let Jeff, while he was in town in Phoenix, do a spot on the show. So hats off to Adam for helping out my friend Jeff, putting him on a packed, sold-out show in front of a big audience. And I was talking to Jeff about the scene. Like, why is he out there? It's like his family's out there. So he was visiting his family and, you know, he was out there for a little while to visit his family in Arizona. And he was telling me there's more stage time in Arizona than there are comedians, which is the opposite of everywhere else. You know, we've been talking about how many, there's too many comedians around, you know, and in Boston, there's definitely not enough stage time with comedians. And well, I could go on about the Boston scene. There was an incident. I'm recording this part back home in Boston and I was at a show talking to a comedian and new things have developed. That's future down the line talk. We'll talk about that stuff later, but Phoenix, I don't know. I can't say that Phoenix was nice. Because I drove in, went to the club, hung out, and then left. And then slept in the car as I drove Sunday to L.A. And I spent the next 36 days in L.A. And I loved every second of it.
Ah!